And then I'll talk about our work, which is a prescription for actually finding what the correct R symmetry is. I'll discuss the results a little bit, and then finally at the end I'll say a couple of words about, I'm going to get rid of, put this thing down, right there, about how you can see some of this from string theory. All right, so why is the R symmetry a good thing? All right, so just as a quick review, as you all know, the n equals 1 four-dimensional superconformal algebra is just SU22/1. The bosonic part of that is just the usual conformal group, and you also have this R symmetry over here. For n equals 1, it's a U1 symmetry. One quick property of the R current is that it's actually in the same, you can write down a supermultiplet that has both the R current and the stress tensor. Important a little bit later on. And since the R current and the supermultiplet, we get that the divergence of the R current and the trace of the stress tensor are also in the same current, and the fact that the theory is conformal implies that the R symmetry is anomaly free. Just a quick review. But what I want to talk about now is what information knowing R charges, for example, tells you. So let's just do a quick review. So there's a whole bunch of stuff you can write down. So for one thing, knowing the R charge of an operator gives you some information about what the exact conformal dimension of that operator is. So for chiral or anti-chiral operators, you get respectively a plus or a minus sign on this bound here. For primary operators, they actually satisfying the R symmetry, knowing the R charge of that operator is basically the same thing as knowing what the dimension of that operator is. Nice thing to know. Let's see, what else? The fact that the U1 R symmetry is anomaly free implies it's an if and only if that the exact NSVZ beta function equals 0. The R symmetry anomaly is exactly the numerator of that beta function. So, good to know. We already knew it was anomaly free, and this is what we expect since this theory is conformal. Something that's going to be very useful for my purposes a little bit later on is that due to a calculation of Anselmi et al., knowing the R charges enables you to figure out the two central charges of this four-dimensional field theory. So you can write down, just like in your two-dimensional conformal field theory, the trace of the stress tensor gives you the central charge times the Ricci scalar. In a four-dimensional theory, you can form these two different curvature invariants, and you actually get two different coefficients there, which are your two central charges. So Anselmi et al. Showed that you can actually write these guys down. I'll explain a little bit about why this is true later on, in terms of these Atuft anomalies for the R cubed and R. So that's a nice thing to know. So just knowing the R charges tells you what these central charges are. And by anomaly matching, you can compute these guys in some weakly coupled theory where you know what's going on, and that they should hold all the way down to some strongly coupled theory. So that's good. All right. Quick aside, let's talk a little bit about the C theorem. So in two-dimensional conformal field theories, there's this result of Zamolodnikov that you have what's called a C. So let's say you have some conformal field theory up here in the UV. Deform that with some relevant perturbation and watch the theory flow down to another conformal field theory in the IR. You can define some quantity which is monotone decreasing along this flow and is equal to the central charges in these two fixed points at the end. And that's the C theorem, that such a quantity exists and that it agrees with the central charges here. That's true in two dimensions, so you might ask, what's true in four dimensions? And in fact, I think the first paper on this paper by Cardi called Is There a C Theorem in Four Dimensions? And he shows there that there are a bunch of counterexamples. Now remember, we have these two central charges. Question is there a C theorem for one of them, both of them, neither? What's up? Well, it turns out for this one that I called C before, it's not necessarily monotone decreasing. You can find some pretty simple counterexamples where that guy actually doesn't decrease. But for this other central charge, A, there are no known counterexamples to it decreasing along RG flow. A is the one, I think, multiplying the Euler. Let me just check that. Yeah, A multiplies the Euler density. And, so there are no known counterexamples to that. For some reason, it's still called the A theorem, but it's never actually been proven. I think there are some claims of a proof, but they're not widely accepted. And I haven't looked at them myself, so I don't know much about those.
What are the counterexamples?
I don't remember exactly what they are off the top of my head, but they're not too weird. I mean, he writes one down. I mean, that's a pretty simple model, so I don't think it's anything too off the wall. So the question is, okay, is there such an A theorem? It seems like, so far, the evidence is pretty good, but there's no proof that everybody believes. And I'll get back to this claim about the A theorem later, because I will have something to say about it. So you also might ask, well, why are we even bothering to study superconformal field theories? It seems like a pretty nice property for a theory to have. Are there enough of these that we would even worry about this? Nothing so far required super.
I mean, because A is defined as symmetry.
That's right,
the A theorem, as far as no holes.
Yeah, that's right. So everything I said so far has nothing to do with super symmetry. It's just a conformal four-dimensional theory. So what I will want to talk about superconformal field theories, what I want to motivate now is the fact that there do appear to be a bunch of interesting superconformal field theories around. So just as a quick example, let's consider super QCD with gauge group SUN C over colors and F flavors. So there's this result of Seiberg that shows that this thing flows to a superconformal field theory, an interesting superconformal field theory, if the number of flavors is within this so-called conformal window. It's between 3/2 the number of colors and 3 times the number of colors. So within here, you can watch the renormalization flow, and this thing flows to some nice conformal theory. I've also written down I haven't motivated this yet, this will come back. These are the global non-R flavor symmetries of that group. You have some NF fundamentals, NF anti-fundamentals, and baryon levers. So of course, that's not to say that there are a lot of these around, it's just one quick example. But it does seem like there are a bunch of theories that do flow to interesting, interacting superconformal field theories. So it seems like a reasonable thing to study properties of these guys. And this is just a little diagram. Beta functions start to look good in the regime where you can start to do these things perturbatively, and then it's hoped that these guys actually do flow to some fixed point as you sort of going around, as you go along. So my point is just that it's probably a good thing to study superconformal field theories. Not that many theories are proven, though, to actually realize interacting superconformal field theories at the endpoint of renormalization group flow. Okay, so that's pretty much all I wanted to say in the way of a review. Properties of the R symmetry gets you some conformal dimensions. You can calculate these central charges, all sorts of great stuff, and then just a little bit of review about the A theorem. So let me tell you the problem now. Everyone agrees, R symmetry rocks. But the problem is, you don't always know what it is. So let's say you've got some superconformal field theory. Generally, you'll have a symmetry group, which is the superconformal algebra I wrote down before, plus, in general, you'll have some global non-R flavor symmetries, non-R in the sense that they commute with the supercharges. So the problem is, let's say you're trying to write down, you're trying to figure out what the R charges are. In general, you can get mixing between the quote-unquote correct U1R in here and these non-R flavor guys. And if you want to know what I mean, in what sense is there a correct U1R, maybe a good way of thinking about that is to say that there's one R symmetry in here, which is the superpartner of the stress tensor. And that's the sense in which I mean the correct U1R. So just to write this down more explicitly, let's say you take some valid R symmetry. Let's just call it R0. Then you can construct any other possible R symmetry, or any other candidate, just by adding to this some linear combination of these flavor charges over here. And this is a possibility for the R symmetry. And without knowing more information, it seems like you could just do any coefficients right there, and you'd have a candidate. So that's the problem. You don't know what the coefficients here are that give you the U1R that's inside the superconformal. All right, so let's just do a quick example or two to motivate this. All right, so I'll do two examples here. The first one I'm going to do is motivated from string theory, and the next one I'll do will be just a little bit of a change from this super QCD example I did before. Okay, so one quicker theory that comes up in the context of ADS-CFT, and I'll go into more detail about exactly how towards the end of the talk, is the theory given by this quiver diagram. So this is, I didn't write it down. There's a UN group at each node here, although the product of the gauge group here is UN to the fourth. And you've got, for each one of these arrows, you have a bi-fundamental, fundamental of this UN and the anti-fundamental of that UN. So there's your quiver theory. You can engineer this through ADS-CFT. Of course, when you do that, you'll generically get, I mean, in this case, you will get a superpotential corresponding theory with this matter content, but with no superpotential. So you can show here, let's see, I've just written down some charges. Here's a possible R symmetry, just something that's anomaly free. It works. And you can also show that you get two non-R flavor symmetries. And just to motivate where that comes from, you got six legs on the quiver here. You could put a U1 in each one, but then there's an anomaly free condition in each node, which leaves you with two guys left over. So I more or less randomly assign charges to these guys. Everything here is anomaly free. Works out. So just to, the only reason I did this is just to give you an explicit realization, and because I'm going to bring up this quiver theory later, that let's say I have this R symmetry here, I can add to this any linear combination of these two flavor symmetries. And I'll talk more about the relation of this to string theory in a little bit. Okay, so that's the stringy example, although with no superpotential. So let's go back to SuperQCD. Only this time, instead of the quarks here, I'm going to throw in another field, one other field, which is an adjoint. So this is just another quick example to show you what the problem is. It's expected, Interligator and Cyberg showed that this guy does flow to a superconformal field theory inside this conformal window. It's a little bit different than the other one. The other one was 3/2 NC to 3 NC, because we've added the adjoint now. And the theory with no superpotential is it's pretty mysterious what's going on. So the global flavor symmetries in this case are, let's see, you've got SUNF times SUNF, because you can do rotations on either of those guys. You have baryon number, and you also have an additional U1 that you can just add in. And I'll actually write down some candidate charges for that in a second. So the anomaly-free condition for the U1 are, let's see, these guys, the adjoint, you have that number of, you can think of these as instanton zero modes. You have that number of zero modes for that instanton, and these guys have, we've normalized such that the quadratic chasm root here is 1. And here, all these minus 1s come in because I'm looking at the R charges of the fermions. So in my convention, R of QI means the R charge of the scalar component of that superfield. So there's the anomaly-free condition for the R symmetry. And let's see what's happened. Well, it seems like a reasonable guess that the R symmetry should commute with rotations on the number of flavors. So let's assume that all these QI have the same R charge mitigation, so that the fundamentals and the anti-fundamentals have the same R charge. So that seems like a reasonable thing. So what I'm going to show you, that actually you can write down a one-parameter family of solutions that satisfy this anomaly-free equation right here. And there's no constraints on the superpotential or anything in this case, since I've just set it equal to 0.
Did Interligator and Cyberg get them what they wanted?
Which one? Oh, no, they didn't. So there's been no way known up until our result here of saying which the correct R symmetry is.
But even without that, they were able to, say that it was superfinal field. The usual argument besides the field ends up going good on the R symmetry.
Yeah, I think their argument is something about how if you look at them, you get, so you can add some, let's see, is that right? I want to say if you look at them in the moduli space, you're going to get some dions and all these different things. And then if you look at the flow, you get a bunch of mutually non-local fields. So, and that there's some interesting superconformal field theory that's coming out of it. So to just continue, conclude the example, the stick is huge. Assuming that arcs are going to have the same R charge, that anomaly-free equation just becomes this. So I can just guess, just write down my candidate values. I can assign all these guys the same R charge, some perfectly good anomaly-free thing, and I can also assign these non-R flavor charges like that. But with this, any R symmetry, which is a combination of these, some unknown parameter times the flavor charges, is a perfectly good R symmetry.
So not knowing R, you don't know the difference.
That's right.
And now, another way to get the exact data function, does that work with the same node states, same ambiguity?
Yes, it does, because the numerator of that exact beta function will be exactly this anomaly-free equation. So yeah, so it's the same anomaly. Yeah, good question. So any one-parameter family is any S here gives a valid R symmetry. So the question is, how do we pick out this S? All right, and that's what I'm going to show you how to do right now. That's correct. Yeah, that's exactly what we're looking at. All right, so I'll just tell you what the resolution is, and then I'll motivate the proof of this. So how do you figure out what the correct R symmetry is? Okay, so let's say that the right R symmetry, the R symmetry inside this this group, is some candidate one plus some specific SIs here times the flavor charges. That's what we want to find. We want to find out what these SI hat are. So our result is the following, that there are some conditions on the Atuft anomalies of these R and flavor symmetries that fix what these parameters need to be. So what are these conditions? Here I've labeled them 1 and 2. This is some condition on this cubic anomaly, R squared, Fi, or Fi has any of the U1 flavor charges. So the condition is that 9 times trace R squared Fi equals Fi. And you can tell by solving this equation, this is some quadratic equation. If I just plug this guy in with some general values of S, I'm going to get some quadratic equation that I can solve for S. And the other condition picks out which of those is the correct root, and that's that this guy, in the sense that needs to be negative, in the sense that this is some matrix in I and J, all the eigenvalues of that need to be negative. So the first equation tells you what your possible roots are. This one picks out what the correct one is. And so that's pretty much the prescription. So what I want to do now is I'll show you where these guys come from. And this is going to be some result that's it just comes from considering properties of n equals 1, d equals 4. All right. So let's prove number 1 first. So I'm just going to give a very, very heuristic derivation here. I don't want to go into too many details. I'd be happy to talk about this more after if anyone wants to see. So here's what I want to prove, is that these two Atuft anomalies are related. Well, the key is that the R current and the stress tensor are in the same supermultiplier. So this looks good. I have two R currents here. I just do some Suzy transformation, and I get those both to be stress tensors. So the Atuft anomaly, R squared with some flavor current here, you have some fermions running around in that triangle diagram, should be related by supersymmetry to something with gravitons over here. So that's basically where this thing comes from. I have that come bottom, but I've already said that. All right, so that's the idea. Suzy relates the R current and the stress tensor, so I should get some relationship between the R squared Fi and Fi. And now you can spend a lot of time checking coefficients and signs and writing out components of multiplets, etc. I'm not going to worry about that right now, but if you go through all the details, you find that the coefficient over here is exactly 9. Right. There's another way of... Yes, Oliver. Why? Yeah, this is... Well, I'm about to motivate this another way, too. Okay. Why can that be related? Oh, it is. That's what I'm saying. Right.
What's the next step?
The motivation for this, if you want, it's something. It's basically just writing out the different components of the. You can write down the anomaly equation, the supersymmetric version of the anomaly equation, which is like d bar squared j equals whatever the anomaly is in terms of field strengths. And then you can work it out. You're right, there's a lot of steps that I'm glossing over here that I'm not saying. But essentially what you can do is you can write out what the coefficients of that anomaly have to be. It turns out that some of them are equal to 0, and the thing that's left over is basically proportional to the square of the supervial curvature. And then if you work out the different components of that, you get that there's one component that's like an R squared part and one component that's like a curvature squared part of field strengths. So it's not obvious from what I've said before that they should be straightforwardly related by this. But another motivation here is this Osborne result, And this, in fact, was what led us to think it was correct at first. There's this paper where he writes down a bunch of correlation functions in just n equals 1 four-dimensional superformal field theories. And he shows that this three-point function is determined up to 1 overall coefficient. So there's a sum invariant tensor of contact terms over here, and then you've got sum overall coefficient. All right, so from this, again, by supersymmetry, this is actually the supercurrent that has both the R symmetry. The lowest component is the R current, next component is the Suzy current, the theta-theta bar component is the stress tensor. So you expect that, okay, well, one component here is going to be the R squared, one component here is going to be gravity, and the flavor. And that if there's just one overall coefficient, all you really need to check is the proportionality. Now, you do have to take a divergence, so this is a little bit freewheeling, but at least, you know, on the level of heuristics, it seems like a reasonable result. So you have to be a little bit more careful here. But just to check this in the free theory to see, so what I should say is there's one overall coefficient here, and you have some tensor. The tensor doesn't depend on the theory. It's some theory-independent result. The only thing that's going to depend on theory is what this coefficient is. And so you can just check the proportionality. So, for example, in a free theory, you know all the R charges are 2/3. R charge in the fermion is going to be minus 1/3. R squared is 1/9. And that gives you the proportionality. Now, so what I've said here is a little bit fast and loose, but you can show all this rigorous. All right. So that's the first condition. Relates to those two components. Now, all right, so now we've picked out the possible roots, those possible values of the S's. Let's see if we can show why, again, not going into huge numbers of details here, why this equation has to be true, why the trace R, Fi, Fj should be less than 0. So again, loosely speaking, we should be able to relate something with an R symmetry here to something with just gravity there. And so let's call this our Tuft anomaly, Krij, and then you have some coefficient here, I'll call tau ij, in this trace anomaly. So what it turns out, it's a well-known property of formal field theories, that the coefficient here in the trace anomaly is actually the same thing as a coefficient that comes up in this current two-point function. And if the conformal field theory is unitary, this thing has to be positive definite. So what you can say is, you can say, okay, well, there's some definite sign to this, so there should be some, we expect some definite sign to this Tuft anomaly. Again, having to be careful about what, you know, the relative minus signs and everything that go on during this procedure of relating one to the other through supersymmetry R. So once you're careful with it, you find that there's actually an additional minus sign here. And in fact, one is related to the other with this extra factor of minus 1/3. This guy's positive definite, so this one has to be negative. Right, so all we've used are just properties of superconformal fields. All right, so that's the condition. So what I want to do now is talk a little bit about what this implies. How am I doing on time? I have no idea what time.
So the bow that always had real, not short.
No. So what we haven't shown, you'd need to check that in a case by case basis that those parameters are all real. But yeah, nothing here ensures that those things are real. Okay, so let's talk about it. All right, here are two conditions. This one picks out the root. This one picks out the set of roots. This one picks out which one is correct. And it turns out that these two conditions together have a very nice interpretation. So let's go back to this thing we've written down a bunch of times now. General trial R symmetry equals some candidate plus some linear combination of the flavor guys. And so the way I want to think about this, sort of a more physical way than just writing down these conditions on the Tuft anomalies, is to say that this is actually the same thing. These two guys are the same as maximizing this quantity right here. Totally weird, but yeah, in some sense. Well, I mean, before this is actually a central charge, it just means it's nothing, right? Yeah. That's right. So somehow this maximizing thing is really weird. It's really weird. When we first saw this, we didn't believe it because It's not what you'd expect, but yeah, somehow it is. So if you just, I mean, just looking at these two, you could just say, I'm going to write down some function, don't worry about this coefficient over there, and I'm going to maximize it. Taking the first derivative, setting it equal to zero, gives you exactly that guy right there. Taking the second derivative and forcing that to have a negative sign, the negative, gives you this condition right here. So maximizing that guy is equivalent to these two conditions. But the pool thing that you've already noticed is that when this R symmetry is the right R symmetry, then this is exactly that expression of enthalpies for the central charge A. So thus the title, the exact R symmetry. And here's the caveat, locally maximizes A. This is, of course, some cubic function, so there's no global maximum. Okay, great. Do a couple examples. Say what?
What ensures that
there is such a local maximum.
There's
no global maximum.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true. If this were for some reason a quadratic equation, then that would be fine. But I mean, certainly you can solve these equations, right? You can write down the solution. But as David pointed out, nothing ensures that you actually get real numbers so far, right? And you want these parameters here to be real numbers in order to give good R charges. So nothing I've shown you so far ensures that. That's true. And that, I mean, almost, I think none of the theories maybe that's not true. Certainly most of the theories we consider in these examples here, no one has proved that they're superconformal. In fact, you might suspect that they're superconformal, and you might say, okay, well, this is nominally free, so the beta function vanishes, but nothing ensures you that the dynamic can actually realize the flow down to that fixed point. So you don't actually know that you have a superconformal theory in many cases. But there's a lot of consistency checks to give you hope that such a theory does exist. Yeah, but that's a good point. Right, very, very quick example. I'll do another one after this, too. So let's see. Okay, let's just say I have some free theory with a bunch of vector supermultiplets, order G, and M chiral superfields, let's say, phi I, or I goes from 1 through M. All right, so let's just assign a bunch of bar charges. At the moment, these are unconstrained up to a nominal period. So, okay, if this is a free theory, we know what we want to get. Let's see if this actually does it for you. So real quick, okay, there's the trial function. You just plug them all in, you get this guy. Enforcing that the first derivative vanish gives you two roots, as you'd expect, 2/3 and 4/3, and then enforcing that the second derivative be negative picks out the correct answer. Okay, great. That was a pretty simple example, though, but at least it gives you some hope that we're not totally lying. All right, another example, and this is substantially more string motivated. So let's get back to this quiver that I wrote down. Well, first let me just throw some numbers at you. Okay, we have this quiver theory here, un groups at each node, and for the moment, let's say there's no superpotential. All right, well, remember I wrote down these R charges. We had two flavor symmetries. You get two parameters, S1 and S2. If you maximize this function A trial that I've been writing down, you get some values here, which are, you know, some real numbers. So at least in this example, everything's working out. And then you can write down the R charges of these fields. What's going to be interesting for me is that we can write down what I'll call AUB, and I'll say why I'm writing that AUB in a second. You get this number when you add up the R charges. Yes, sorry, my S's and 5's are indistinguishable. Yeah. Is that 1 plus root 5 over 2? 1 minus root 5 over 2? 1 plus. So it's close. Okay, so here's what I want to do now, is I want to throw in some superpotential as a relevant deformation and see what happens, and then flow down to the other theory. And the reason I picked, you might say, you picked this superpotential, because, I mean, you have a bunch of possible, this is actually every gauge invariant loop that I could get out of that quiver, but this is the one that comes up naturally from ADS-CFT, is induced by string theory. So this is, oh, this is a mistake. Enforcing that this thing is flavor neutral, neutral under the other flavor symmetries, that takes the appropriate linear combination of these two guys to give us only one. And then it turns out that if you, okay, so now you have one parameter, maximize that function A, and it turns out the R charges I wrote down four are exactly the right one. And we actually knew those beforehand from string theory. That's what I'll say a little bit more about later on in the talk. So, okay, you can just write down the R charges, there they are. Not particularly interesting numbers in and of themselves. But what's nice here is that the central charge A in this theory is less than the central charge up there. So this is yet another example that's consistent with the A. Okay, good. Cool. All right, so let's talk about this result. So I'm going to make a bold claim, which is, on the surface, nonsense. This almost proves the A theorem. What does it mean to almost prove nothing? So, okay, well, what the hell? So, okay, why would I say this almost proves the A theorem? So let's say, okay, you've got your UV theory, relevant deformation, flow down some IR theory. Generally, you'll break some flavor symmetries when you do this. So in many cases, you'll find that the non-R symmetries in the IR theory are some subset of the non-R symmetries in the UV theory. And you might expect that, okay, so now we've got some smaller subset of things we're maximizing over. Maybe this would lead to a smaller value. Of course, that's a pretty fast and loose argument, so let me tell you everything that's wrong. All right, caveats. This is just simply not true, that the IR symmetries are always a subset of the UV symmetries. In many cases, you can get accidental symmetries, which were just simply not around in the UV theory, but as you go to the IR, then you see them. So it's not true that these guys are always a subset of these guys. Now you can check these to say, okay, well, what about then? There are plenty of known examples here. Do those violate the A theorem? The answer is no, they do not, but this is by no means a proof, and this is something our result has nothing to say about. And of course, there's the even simpler objection that just because we're maximizing over a subset doesn't mean that the value is getting smaller. Remember, this is in general some cubic function. What if when we're maximizing over the subset, somehow we come over here? We don't. No, it's because this thing is cubic overall. You can't have more than one. But this thing could run away, and there's nothing that tells you when you're maximizing over some subset. It doesn't. Yeah, I'm just drawing some one-dimensional. One global local max. I think in general. Can't you argue, can't you slice the thing around with different planes and then so overall it's probably, yeah, I think would not be some cubic thing. Yeah, that's right. There can't be one. All right, what else? One other warning is that when I wrote this thing down, I assumed we knew what all the symmetries were. And if you didn't know that, so for example, you look at the Lagrange and you see what the symmetries are. But sometimes you get enhanced symmetries in strongly coupled theory that you couldn't see in some weakly coupled Lagrangian description. And then there's no way, we have nothing to say about those, since we needed to incorporate all these flavor symmetries to make our argument work. All right, so those are the warnings. Let me tell you an interesting prediction here, actually, is that, okay, well, we're solving, to get these S's, we're solving quadratic equations with rational coefficients. So, well, when you're solving those, that means the solutions will always be algebraic numbers. So the R charges, I should be more careful here, the R charges are primary operators, of course, not R charges in general. So, you know, if you have some charge that runs with the coupling, you can get anything you want. And central charges will always be algebraic numbers. And so this is some prediction about superconformal field theories. And this is sort of along with spirit, in the spirit of rational conformal field theories. This is some instead of rational algebraic. All right, so that's a non-trivial prediction about supernova buildings. All right. So that pretty much ends the purely field theory part of the talk. And what I want to talk about now is how you can see some of these guys from string theory. All right, so let's talk a little bit about how to engineer n equals 1 four-dimensional superconformal field theories. So this is well known how to do in ADS CFT. So you take a big stack of D3 brains here, and in the compact directions we have some six-dimensional manifold, which is a cone, over some other five-dimensional manifold. And so in the large and limit, of course, then we have the duality between ADS5 times this horizon and the four-dimensional field theory of living companies. So if this is specifically a Calabi-Yau manifold, then you'll get some n equals 1 superconformal field theory living on these D-brains. So it turns out that with a not very restrictive assumption, you can get this this 5 manifold here to be a U1 fiber over some other four-dimensional manifold. And this is when you hear the phrase regular Einstein-Sasaki manifold, or I guess quasi-regular Einstein-Sasaki for that five-dimensional guy. That implies that it's a U1 fiber over some other four-dimensional manifold. And in general, for ADS CFT, we expect that in classic example ADS5 and S5, the isometry group of that S5 is related to the R symmetry. So in this case, we have some U1 isometry, which is related to the R symmetry. Okay, great. So in general, when you do this, we'll get some nice quiver theory. Oh, well, that's a typo. I'm assuming we're not using Orient folds or anything like that. You'll get some product of UN groups where I've just kind of factored out the N here and then written a bunch of other coefficients, D alpha, and those will depend on the singularity structure of the manifold. So you have some product of UN groups. This quiver is, you know, you'll have some bifundamental stretching between all cone nodes alpha and beta. These are some chiral superfields, and let's say that we have N alpha beta flavors between nodes alpha and beta. So just from the point of view of knowing stuff about the conformal field theory, we'd like to know some stuff about these guys, right? We'd like to know, for example, the R charges of these operators, and we'd like to know the charges of these operators and under any global flavor symmetries, much in the spirit of what we were doing before. Now, what's cool here is that string theory tells you what these charges need to be. And so that's what I want to talk about. All right, so let's just do one of these mandatory charts where I compare the superconformal field theory to the string theory. All right, well, continuous global symmetries in the field theory are related to gauge symmetries in the ADS bulk over here. In particular, this U1R couples to a gauge field that you get by Kaluza-Klein reducing the metric on this guy. And the global symmetries correspond to the global symmetries in the field theory. Those currents couple to the gauge fields that you get by reducing the Ramon-Ramon 4 form on sub-3 cycle of the horizon manifold. And the objects that are going to be particularly interesting for us are going to be these baryons or dibaryons, which correspond to D3 brains in string theory wrapping some 3 cycle. And these D3 brains give you a useful way of checking R charges and flavor charges. So let's see. Okay, so here's our horizon of the cone. As I said, it's some U1 fibrate over some four-dimensional manifold. If I have some D3 brain, which I want to correspond to a baryon, I want to be some point-like object, it's going to wrap this U1 fiber. I know that has to be true because it should have some R charge that U1 corresponds to the R symmetry. And to make them stable supersymmetric objects, they also have to wrap some homomorphic 2 cycle in that four manifold. So let's see. Well, talking in terms of complex dimensions, a 2-cycle in that 4-dimensional manifold is a codimension 1 curve, and that's also known as a divisor in algebraic geometry language. So we have some correspondence here between baryons and divisors. All right, how am I doing on time then? What?
Quarter.
Oh, great. We'll be done pretty soon. So let's see. Now, what I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here about is how you can write down these charges just by knowing information about the geometry of this horizon manifold. So, for example, let's say I have some baryon Q alpha beta. In this case, I'm speaking loosely about the distinction between baryons and bifundamentals. Let's say all those D alphas I wrote down before equal to 1 in this case. Have some correspondence between this baryon Q alpha beta and this divisor L alpha beta. So it turns out that you can write the R charge of these guys as something in terms of intersection numbers of the corresponding divisor and the first Chern class of this four-dimensional manifold. This is straightforward to show how to do. What's also cool is that you can write down non-R charges in terms of these divisors. So let's say, okay, I've got some divisor on this four-dimensional manifold that's orthogonal to the first Chern class. So heuristically, the reason I want to say that this is a non-R symmetry is because it's not charged under this guy. It's orthogonal, so it's numerator is zero. So then we found that the corresponding charge is actually given by just intersecting this guy with the corresponding divisor. And so what you do is you write down the first Chern class, you should write down all of the things that are orthogonal to it, and then everything you get will correspond to some flavor symmetry. You can get all the charges just by writing down these intersection numbers. So all these charges, R charges, all these U1 charges, R charges, not R flavor charges, just topological stuff. Good. All right, let's get back to this Clear example, which I love so well. All right, so there it is, up the top. Same quiver, seen a couple times now, and we have this cubic-cubic quartic superpotential. So as I said, I'd go into more detail. How do you get this from string theory? So the question is, what geometry do I use on the string theory side? Turns out that this four-dimensional manifold is this thing called DP1, otherwise known as the DP1 stands for the first Del Pezzo surface. This is P2 blown up at some point. So I just take P2, blown up at some point. That's my geometry. So if you think about it, you see that DP1 has two linearly independent codimension 1 objects on it. One is the pullback of the hyperplane just from P2, and the other is this exceptional divisor, which corresponds to the point that we just blew up. So you can write down intersection numbers. So this hyperplane is just some line intersecting itself. You can move it around, any line intersects another line once. So you get 1 here. Exceptional curves have self-intersection -1. And since we can always take this divisor and move it away from the exceptional point, these two guys do not intersect. First Chern class of DP1 is just the first Chern class of P2, but taking into account that we've got this exceptional divisor here, so you can subtract that off. And so I notice when I'm looking for stuff that's orthogonal to this, I can write down something pretty quickly. I just take this guy and I dot it in there, I get 0. So that's our candidate for the flavor divisor. All right, so you can show that these guys, so there's this paper of Beasley and Plesser where they write down correspondence between, for the DP3 case, between baryons and divisors. You can Higgs those down and show what the corresponding divisors in the DP1 example are. And then just by intersecting with the first Chern class to get the R charge, or with this other guy, J, to get the flavor charge, you can write down this nice little matrix of charges. And that's exactly the same thing. This R charges are exactly the same thing we found before. So somehow string theory knew this. All right. And you can do this for lots of other examples. Del Pezzo's, etc. In one of Chris's papers, they do these for these generalized conflicts. So let's see. Okay, what else? This is pretty weird. I like this. So it turns out that now we know the R charges in terms of the divisors, we can write down some additional formulae. So let's see, if you write down this cubic toothed anomaly, you just get, all right, you get something. This is just some field theory thing. You can just write that down. It's the cubic one. And let's see, well, you also know from ADS CFT that this trace R cubed is equal to this. It's this ratio of volumes of S5, some normalization factor, to the volume of this horizon manifold. So somehow what's going on here is you have this, what looks like a pretty weird identity that tells you some relation between the divisors on the surface. And you can get these number of flavors also by looking at divisors on the surface. And 1 over the volume of this thing. Pretty weird. You can actually relate this a little bit to what we said before. In all these examples that you engineer from string theory, trace R is equal to 0, and the A and C central charges are the same. So, okay, A is just proportional then to trace R cubed. Maximizing A is somehow some sort of volume minimizing thing over here, which is sort of plausible. So this is some non-trivial math identity, and string theory does have some examples. You can do all sorts of other stuff here, which I won't get into detail about. You can look at the action of cyber duality on these divisors, what happens when you start wrapping D5 brains, etc. And all this, the point of all this is just to show you that these divisors are very useful tools for talking about these charges. Okay, that's it. Conclusions. So now we know how to find cross. We know how to find all these R charges, and that gives us access to a lot of information that we didn't know before. Now that we can find these, we can talk about dimensions of primary operators, all this great stuff. So this reveals a bunch of insight into previous mysterious superformal field theories. As I said, we have this quote-unquote almost proof of the A theorem. Certainly there are a bunch of things you need to worry about, but this seems like a step in the right direction. And finally, I guess in the spirit of an open problem, I'd like to understand how you get these weird math identities that, like this one I wrote down before, that relates the 1 over the volume of your 5-manifold to some bizarre thing in terms of the divisors. We showed this to a couple algebraic geometers, and they were like, weird. So this is not some obvious thing that the mathematicians know about. And in fact, I doubt that it's some general thing. There's probably some restrictive assumptions you have to put on what these manifolds have to be. That's it. Thank you. Question.
So there's a few features of the gas, especially in CFT, the normalization of flows, gravity flow, in terms of some components and stuff. So some action.
Yeah, I don't know anything about this.
When you find the bag, which is reminiscent of solving some sort of an action, they have to map on gravity. So when you thought about whether it's related to this idea of having the RG flow in some sort of a component system where the direction you go down the flow is the time direction.
Yeah, no, I haven't thought about that at all. It's an interesting point. I didn't know anything about that.
So,
I have nothing to say about that. I haven't thought about that. That's a good point. Cool. Thanks for bringing that up. I certainly wouldn't know the answer to that. Yeah, I have no idea what happened with finite.
Would you be surprised if it was, general, but also treated data?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I was talking to Henrietta before too. And I don't know if this is related to. I should let you finish your question.
Same thing.
Yeah. Is it obvious to him? In the context of what? That's not complex.
Yeah. Chapter. I'm pretty sure I just never seen that, but I almost forgot to tell that skin.
On that note.
It's like they're in a proof where like something comes up or something. Oh, thanks a lot, Jeff. Yeah.